Hello, you're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 8, June and July. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades. We've reached a kind of turning point in the narrative of the Russian Revolution that birthed the Soviet Union. Or at least, I conceive of it as a turning point. In this episode, we will be discussing the events in Petrograd and on the military front of June and July 1917. These events will serve as a catalyst for what very nearly was the end of the Bolshevik quest for workers' power. Up to now, the Bolsheviks have been just one party among many vying for influence among the workers and soldiers of Russia, and the political landscape has been kind of an open field. Various forces have been traveling in different directions, and if we did not already know how things would turn out, it would be difficult to guess who would come out on top. The Soviets or the Provisional Government, the SRs, the Mensheviks, or the Bolsheviks. But after the events we will be discussing today, there will be some clarity. A kind of tipping point will be reached in the consciousness of the masses, and while we will be leaving the Bolsheviks at the nadir of their influence and prestige, starting next time, there will be a remarkable bounce back in their fortunes, which will set everything on a steady course toward the fateful month of October. The thing is, a lot happens in the roughly 6-week period we are covering. We could parse through every event, every twist and turn, and stretch this period of time into 2 or possibly even 3 episodes. But everything from early June to about mid-July is kind of just happening all at once, with events acting and reacting upon each other in one continuous chain, culminating in a near miss for everyone involved. So instead, we are just going to work our way through it, focusing more on big picture developments instead of daily minutiae, until we come out on the other side. First, we have the political event that started the whole thing, the Congress of Soviets. The first all-Russian Congress of Soviets took place from the 3rd to the 24th of June, and a friendly reminder that these are old-style dates, so 13 days behind our current calendar, and is significant to the overall history of the Soviet Union because the all-Russian Congress of Soviets will act as the supreme governing body of the Soviet Union until the new constitution of 1936, the so-called Stalin Constitution, went into force and established the Supreme Soviet. That is, of course, getting way ahead of ourselves, but I wanted to point out that the first 18 years of Soviet governance had its starting point right here. The demographics of this first Congress were as follows. 1,088 delegates, with 820 delegates with deciding votes, and 268 delegates with advisory votes. Whether a vote was deciding or advisory was determined on the basis of how many individuals a delegate represented. Delegates had to be from a Soviet representing a district of at least 25,000 people to have a deciding vote. Of the 1,088 delegates, 777 declared their party affiliation, which broke down to 285 SRs, 248 Mensheviks, 105 Bolsheviks, and 139 delegates from various other smaller groups and parties. As these figures suggest, a majority of the delegates represented the pro-government Menshevik SR bloc. Tensions between this bloc and the Bolsheviks would come to define the Congress. In the beginning, there were many speeches against the Bolshevik party and leadership, particularly Lenin, and calls by the Bolshevik delegation to end the war and the slogan, "All power to the Soviets," were dismissed. By the end, though, the Bolsheviks will have the last laugh. In terms of actual policies voted on, these are some of the details we are skipping over, but just to give a taste of what was decided on, the Congress voted down the proposal to make the 8-hour workday official, which, if you remember, was one of the demands of the workers way back in February, and here they are, still fighting for it. But hey, at least they voted for a new coalition with the Provisional Government, and reaffirmed the Soviet position in support of the war. The workers and soldiers in the capital were, as you can imagine, thrilled to hear this. But like I said a moment ago, it's really the tensions between the competing blocs and the Soviet that make this Congress noteworthy. It all started when the Bolshevik paper Pravda announced on the 9th of June that a street demonstration was being planned for the next day, the 10th. This provoked a firestorm in the Congress, with accusations that the Bolsheviks were planning a coup. They pointed to the fact that the demonstration had been planned in secret and was being called for only 24 hours in advance, which lent to a sense that this was all some sort of sneak attack that was being sprung on the Congress by the Bolsheviks. For their part, the Bolsheviks admitted that, yes, the planning of the demonstration had been done in secret, but this was to protect against outside interference. They insisted the demonstration was supposed to be only that, a demonstration. Nothing nefarious was being concocted. And it must be said, the accusations of a sneak attack sound a bit ridiculous when you think about how many sneak attacks in history have actually been announced a full day ahead of time. Not many. If it had been intended as a sneak attack, which I do not believe for a second was the case, announcing it like that was a horrible tactical blunder. Nonetheless, immense pressure was placed on the Bolsheviks to cancel the march. The Bolsheviks at first refused, but they were soon caught in the middle. Despite the sincere claims from the Bolshevik leadership that they had only been planning a march, there were calls from many of the workers to overthrow the government and establish the Soviets as the new governing body, or at least to be ready if the opportunity presented itself. The Bolshevik leadership, most of them anyway, correctly understood that this would be disastrous. We will get into why some, but not all, of them understood the danger of such an action toward the end of the episode. But it was not just pressure from below with which the Bolshevik leadership had to contend. There was also pressure from their political right. The SRs and Mensheviks gave threats and implications that the demonstration would be met with government force if any attempts at insurrection were made. Rightfully concerned that the demonstration could get out of hand, either because of overzealous workers in the streets or pushback by the authorities, the Bolsheviks ultimately and hastily sent out many delegations to the factories and barracks to politely but firmly call the demonstration off. The workers and soldiers grumbled, but after confirming that this request was genuine and coming from the Bolsheviks themselves, and not some attempt at a trick by other parties to keep them from demonstrating, they complied, and the demonstration was called off. However, only days later, the SR Menshevik leadership of the Congress made an astounding miscalculation. An unforced error is the sports term. Thinking that they had cowed the Bolsheviks sufficiently, they announced there would be a pro-government demonstration on the 18th of June. They believed they could muster patriotic Russians who would show their support for the war, and particularly the June offensive, which was being launched the same day, and to which we will get in just a bit. In a display of confidence that would leave him deeply embarrassed, Irakli Tsereteli, a Georgian Menshevik, announced to the Bolshevik delegation of the Congress, quote, "Now there is before us an open and honest review of the revolutionary forces. Now we will see whom the majority follows, you or us," end quote. But in a development that should have been obvious to anyone contemplating the overall strategy of the moment, the demonstration wound up providing a Soviet-sanctioned outlet for the workers and soldiers who had just called off their own demonstration in support of the Bolsheviks the week before. 500,000 people turned out at the march, and Trotsky describes the scene. Quote, "The delegates of the Congress who had gathered at the Field of Mars read and counted the placards. The first Bolshevik slogans were met as a half-joke, but those same slogans repeated again and again. Down with the 10 capitalist ministers. Down with the offensive. All power to the Soviets. A smile of irony first hardened on their faces, then slowly disappeared from them. The Bolshevik banners sailed without end. The delegates abandoned their thankless counts. The victory of the Bolsheviks was too apparent." End quote. In the end, the Soviet leadership was thoroughly embarrassed at the showing, and compensated by attacking the Bolsheviks in the press even more fiercely. As for the Bolsheviks themselves, the demonstration showed that they enjoyed majority support among the workers and soldiers of the capital. However, this was a double-edged sword, as it would turn out. After witnessing firsthand the support and numbers that they wielded, calls for an immediate overthrow of the government only intensified. The Bolsheviks, and Lenin specifically, wound up working tirelessly for almost the entire month of June to plead with the masses, and even some Bolsheviks, not to attempt a premature overthrow of the government. We will see by the end of the episode what exactly came of all of this. We now turn to the military crisis that is the June Offensive. As I mentioned just a moment ago, the official start of the offensive took place on the same day as the Soviet demonstration in Petrograd, the 18th of June. But to understand why the offensive was taking place to begin with, we need to look at the state of the army, the state of the government, and look for an answer as to what exactly the government was thinking. To begin our survey of the army, it is fair to say that the imperial army that the provisional government inherited after February was a microcosm of the class divisions in society at large. As a general rule, rank-and-file soldiers were drawn from the peasantry and the proletariat, while the officers and generals were nobility, aristocrats, or sons of bourgeois families. For example, the Admiral Alexander Vasilievich Kolchak was from a noble military family with ancestors who had participated in most major military campaigns of the Russian Empire for nearly 200 years. The General Pyotr Nikolaevich Wrangel was a baron descended from Danish emigres, whose ancestors had fought in wars including the Patriotic War against Napoleon in 1814, as well as in the wars against the Ottomans. Commander Nikolai Nikolaevich Yudenich came from more humble origins, but was still the son of a court official in Moscow. General Alexei Alexeyevich Brusilov had aristocratic ancestors for at least as far back as the mid-1600s, possibly as early as the 1400s. The most noteworthy exception to this trend was Anton Ivanovich Denikin, who was born the son of a Russian former serf and a Polish seamstress. But his father rose up the ranks of a military career, and Anton followed, so that by the end of World War I and the Revolution, he had spent his entire adult life in the military, and so his worldview was molded and informed by his peers of noble or aristocratic heritage. The point is not that family origins are entirely and rigidly deterministic in and of themselves. If they were, Denikin never would have become a general in the Imperial Army. The point is that systems shape attitudes and work to limit outcomes. The overwhelming majority of generals and officers in the Imperial Army were from noble families, and the overwhelming majority of rank-and-file soldiers were peasants and workers. This was no accident. The structure of the Russian Empire had been engineered for centuries to produce this outcome. Every once in a while, a Denikin rises through the ranks of the military and sides with the empire and the ruling class, or a Lenin from a minor noble family breaks with his class interests and sides with the proletariat. But these examples do not disprove the rule that material conditions shape outlooks and worldviews. This class division in the army lends further credence to the repeated claims by the Bolsheviks that the revolution and the war were both arenas of class conflict. Because the officer corps was absolutely determined to continue the war, and the soldiers were desperate to end it, it comes as no surprise the Bolshevik Party, with their unequivocal stance against the war, wound up making such widespread advances in the rank and file of the armed forces. And when we consider those advances, we see that the same phenomenon we discussed last time with the Bolshevik Party and the workers played out with the soldiers. Membership in the party among the armed forces grew rapidly as the year went on. On the eve of the February Revolution, there were only some 2,000 Bolsheviks in the entire Russian army. By April, the number was 6,000. By mid-June, on the eve of the offensive, it was 26,000. This was despite efforts from both the military and civilian authorities at censorship. Copies of the Bolshevik papers like Pravda and Soldatskaya Pravda, or Soldier's Truth, were frequently confiscated or swapped out for the cadet paper Reich, or the Menshevik paper Dien. I mentioned before that on the eve of the February Revolution, morale in the armed forces was abysmal. It should come as absolutely no shock that, despite the efforts of the government, as spring progressed into summer 1917, discipline and morale continued to plummet. Discipline became so bad that multiple reports came in from the front that generals and officers doubted whether their orders would be followed. On the 27th of May, the government ordered the disbanding of the 45th, 46th, 47th, and 52nd regiments for insubordination. Which is why it seems absolutely insane that so many of the national leaders at the time, both in the provisional government and the Soviets, believed not only in a continuation of the war, but even planned the June offensive, and spoke about war until victory. How could this be so? The rhetoric employed by these individuals was of extreme patriotism. Victory in the war was a point of national pride for many of them, and it was genuinely difficult to accept the fact that there was no way for Russia to win the war. But of course, this is a socialist podcast, which means we need to look behind the rhetoric and search for the material realities which give rise to the mentality. Such a search reveals the true driving forces behind this desperate refusal to accept a loss, and the furious attempts to continue the fight. From the point of view of the business owners, landlords, and old aristocracy now running the official government of Russia, the material implications of leaving the war were too horrific to even entertain. The war was the primary excuse the government used to delay dealing with the demands of the revolution. Every major question of domestic politics, land reform, workers' rights, the Constituent Assembly, all of it, was subordinated, at least rhetorically, to the war effort. The bourgeoisie was absolutely convinced they had to win the war. The future of the Russian economy had been pinned to this outcome. Once the war was won by the Allied powers, Russia would partake in the spoils of war. Whatever would be left over after all the death and destruction, anyway, in order to rebuild the economy. The Russian bourgeoisie would stand with Britain, France, and now the United States, who had entered the war on the 6th of April, 1917, atop the new capitalist world pecking order. This, in turn, would put them in a much stronger, almost dominant position domestically, and then they would be able to take care of the revolution. But if Russia did not make it across that finish line and withdrew from the war, not only would none of that come to pass, their allies, France and Britain, would make sure Russia paid the price for abandoning its post, as it were. Both allies placed enormous pressure on the government to honor the Tsar's commitments to the war, threatening to cut off aid in the form of loans and equipment if Russia did not launch an offensive against Germany from the east. There was, of course, one tiny problem in all of this thinking. Everybody knew that it was absolute crazy talk. Practically nobody, from the soldiers, workers, and peasants, to the officer corps, to even the government ministers and leaders in the Soviets, actually believed the war could be won. It's just that the workers and peasants were not afraid to say it out loud. Their material interests corresponded with the reality of the situation. The war is lost, so we need to end the war. But the material interests of the ruling classes demanded the opposite. To paraphrase Upton Sinclair, it's nearly impossible to get the ruling classes to admit defeat when their interests depend on victory. But to make the delusion of victory even more ridiculous, even if somehow, by some miracle, the war ended tomorrow and the Allies were victorious, of the now four victorious nations, Russia would far and away be in the weakest position. The economic, political, and demographic ruin wrought by the war on Russia was on the same level, and in some cases worse, than the ruin wrought on the German and Austro-Hungarian empires. Could the Russian bourgeoisie and landowners really hope that, out of the goodness of their hearts, and as a reward for the sacrifices Russia had made for the victory of all, that Britain, France, and the U.S. would prioritize Russia's needs when dividing up the spoils of war? Or is it conceivable that they would just take advantage of the weakened state of Russia for their own benefit, just as they would do with their defeated enemies? So now we can see that the Russian ruling classes were caught in a bind. The only thing worse for them than continuing fighting a lost war was not continuing the fight. And so, they were forced to keep fighting. France and Britain continued to demand the Russians set a date for an offensive against the Germans' Eastern Front. And finally, it was scheduled, as we said, for the 18th of June. This meant the government and the Russian military command had limited time to try to regain control over the soldiers and convince, cajole, or threaten them to go along with the attack. This included, as we already discussed, the Congress of Soviets officially endorsing the continuation of the war. The June offensive, which is sometimes called the Kerensky Offensive, since Alexander Kerensky was the Minister of War at the time, had the stated goal of driving the Austro-Hungarians out of Lemberg, modern-day Lviv in western Ukraine, and Galicia, a region covering modern-day western Ukraine and southern Poland. There were multiple fronts involved in the operation. The southwestern front was to be the main theater, as that was where the targets were geographically located, while the western, northern, and Romanian fronts were assigned an auxiliary role of distracting the Central Powers away from the main targets. The Provisional Government and the Soviets went into an all-out propaganda blitz to try to drum up support among the soldiers and the masses for what they still insisted was the patriotic duty of all in Russia. Even Kerensky himself toured the front to appeal to the soldiers directly. Trotsky describes an interesting exchange between the Black Sea and Baltic fleets in the run-up to the offensive. The Black Sea fleet was at the time more aligned with the SRs and was also geographically isolated from Petrograd, as it was some 2,100 kilometers south from the capital. They sent a delegation of 300 sailors from the Black Sea Fleet to Petrograd and other key military centers in order to spread the gospel about war until victory. However, at the same time, the Baltic Fleet sent a delegation down to the Black Sea Fleet headquarters in Sevastopol. The Baltic Fleet was headquartered at the naval base at Kronstadt in the Gulf of Finland outside Petrograd and was a bastion of Bolshevik support. And so this delegation preached just the opposite, peace and the Sovietization of the fleet. Trotsky, quote, "The Northerners had more success in the south than the Southerners did in the north. Under the influence of the Kronstadtists, on the 8th of June, the Sevastopol sailors took steps toward the disarming of the command and the arrest of the most hated officers," end quote. This was not an isolated example of the failures of the propaganda blitz. In the lead-up to the offensive, the Cadet, Menshevik, and SR papers in Petrograd and elsewhere ran articles calling for patriotic solidarity and complete support of the war effort. But, as we saw, on the day of the offensive, the people of Petrograd proved they would have none of that. Within the army, for weeks before the scheduled start of the offensive, reports were coming in from nearly every quarter that the troops were simply not ready. At the end of May, the Commissar of the 7th Army reported to Kerensky that in the 12th Division, all the soldiers of the 48th Regiment had reported for duty, whereas the 45th and 46th Regiments saw only half the troops report for duty, and the 47th refused entirely to report. In the 13th Division, the 50th Regiment reported for duty in its entirety, the 51st kept promising to report tomorrow, while the 49th Regiment had failed to report as scheduled, and the 52nd Regiment was not only refusing to report, but they had also arrested their officers. On the 4th of June, 2 weeks before the start of the offensive, the Chief of Staff at Army Headquarters reported, quote, "The Northern Front finds itself still in a state of agitation. Fraternization with the enemy continues, while among the infantry, the attitude toward the offensive is negative. On the Western Front, the state of affairs is unclear. On the southwestern front, some improvement in mood can be observed. On the Romanian front, no particular improvement is observed. The infantry does not wish to attack. End quote. Faced with a complete and total lack of faith in the regular soldiers and sailors, the provisional government had no choice but to attempt to organize an offensive without them. General Brusilov, with Kerensky's approval, began forming shock battalions composed of volunteers. The turnout for these battalions, however, was rather pathetic, and in raw numbers, there were simply nowhere near enough troops. Even the high command openly wrote to each other and the politicians back in Petrograd that they had precisely zero expectations of success in the operation. In terms of manpower, supplies, and logistics, the Russian army was, quite simply, not up to the task. However, the die had already been cast, and there was no turning back. The offensive, unsurprisingly, did not get off to a good start. First of all, despite the plan for everyone to attack all at once, only the southwestern front advanced as scheduled on the 18th of June, after 2 days of artillery barrage. The western front went into action on the 7th of July, the northwestern front only the following day. The Romanian front mobilized the day after that, on the 9th. On the southwestern front, there was some limited, temporary success. As we discussed a few episodes back, after the February Revolution, the Eastern Front for Germany had been quiet as the Russian army was suddenly overwhelmed by the events in Petrograd. The Germans and Austro-Hungarians had taken the opportunity to transfer troops to the Western Front to fight, which explains why the French and British were so desperate for the Russians to re-engage and take some of the pressure off them. And so, with a skeleton crew manning the lines, the Russian army, that is, the volunteer battalions and the relative handful of regular troops that had reported for duty after all, captured and occupied large swaths of territory very quickly. However, after the initial push by the Russians, it took the Central Powers just a few days to send their own troops back into the fray. The Russian troops, for their part, began deserting and retreating in droves, in some instances before the Central Powers even managed to counterattack. By the time the other fronts were entering the attack in July, the main goal of the entire campaign, Lemberg and Galicia, had already been lost to the Russian army in the face of the near total disintegration of the southwestern front. In the end, the offensive was, militarily speaking, a complete and total failure. The goal of the campaign was not achieved, and all the army had to show for it was tens of thousands more casualties. Politically speaking, the fallout would be enormous, and would hit the capital, Petrograd, hard and fast. Speaking of, if you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. As I am just starting out, I do not yet have Patreon-exclusive material. However, if the Patreon page attracts enough attention, that will definitely change. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. In the final weeks of June, as the Kerensky offensive was going as well as everyone expected it to, the people of Petrograd were not taking things lying down. Living and working conditions were always and everywhere first and foremost on everyone's minds. Workers undertook campaigns to recall and re-elect the representatives in the Petrosoviet, which led to significant changes in the makeup of delegates. After the elections, Trotsky put the Bolshevik bloc at 2/5 of the delegates in the Petrosoviet. The soldiers were still heavily overrepresented in those remaining 3/5, but Trotsky estimates that among the workers of Petrograd, the Bolsheviks enjoyed significant, and possibly majority, support. As for those soldiers in the capital that made up three-fifths of the Petro-Soviet, the government did a fantastic job royally pissing them off as well. Some of the troops received orders on the 19th to prepare for mobilization away from the capital, a place where none of them wanted to leave, to the front, a place where none of them wanted to go. There were also orders for the other military units to relinquish their arms and munitions so that these could be sent to the front. These orders violated a promise given by the provisional government that troops in the capital who had participated in the February Revolution would not be sent out of Petrograd or disarmed. So the temperature in the capital was being brought up to a boil as June transitioned to July. The soldiers were incensed by the demands of the government. The workers were angry that their demands for an 8-hour workday were being ignored, working conditions continued to deteriorate, and inflation still ran rampant. And both groups were enraged that the war was not only not over, but a new offensive was being crammed down their throats. This combined with two other important facts to influence the mindset of the Petrograd masses. First, there was the gains the Bolsheviks were making specifically in Petrograd after the elections to the Petro-Soviet. And second, there was the fact that the Congress of Soviets street demonstration on the 18th of June had demonstrated that the masses of the capital were practically all of one mind. And so it was that a majority of the workers and soldiers in the capital believed now not only that it was necessary to overthrow the provisional government and force the Soviets to take power, but that they had the numbers to do it. The Bolshevik leadership was split on how to respond to these new demands. All through June, Lenin and his supporters argued that such calls were premature. But much to Lenin's frustration, other Bolsheviks disagreed, thinking the moment had come for the workers to take control. The Petersburg Committee of the Bolshevik Party met on the 20th of June and objected to Lenin's line, claiming it was dereliction of duty for the Bolsheviks not to lead an insurrection when the rank and file demanded it. On the 22nd, the Bolshevik military organization, which was in charge of agitation and organization among the armed forces, expressed their desire to lead an insurrection and overthrow the government. And as we've seen many times already, the Bolsheviks were not a monolithic force, and Lenin had to struggle mightily for his ideas. On the 27th of June, absolutely exhausted from the Congress and all the work he had to put in day and night for weeks on end, Lenin left Petrograd for a week or two for a comrade's dacha in Finland in order to catch his breath. But he would only get a couple of days rest because on the 3rd of July, the proverbial poop would hit the proverbial fan. And when Lenin heard about it, he rushed back to the capital to set himself to the Herculean task of restraining the masses and keeping them from making a grave mistake. We come now to the turning point I mentioned in the beginning, the July days. First, we will walk through the events in question, and then discuss their significance and consequences. On the 3rd of July, representatives from the 1st Machine Gun Regiment went around to the factories and workshops and began calling for the overthrow of the government. The workers enthusiastically joined in, and by the afternoon, 500,000 armed bodies were in the streets. Many of the richer inhabitants of the city began buying train tickets to get out of the capital as quickly as possible, and in some quarters of the city, gunfire could be heard. There were reports of a failed attempt to arrest Kerensky, and the insurgents took control of the Peter and Paul Fortress, that strategically vital fort in the heart of the city, located on an island in the Neva, directly across from the Winter Palace. The Bolshevik leadership in Petrograd, the military organization, the citywide Petersburg Committee, and the Central Committee for the entire party, were faced with demands by the demonstrators turned insurgents to endorse their demands for an end to the government and a transfer of power to the Soviets. In a move that would come back to haunt them, the leadership bowed to the pressure of the demonstrators and belatedly endorsed their actions. On the morning of the 4th of July, news came to Lenin of what was happening in the capital. Horrified that his party was on the verge of leading the workers to a crushing defeat, Lenin caught the next train back to Petrograd, arriving a few hours later. He went immediately to the Bolshevik Party headquarters at Kashinskaya Manor, where he was greeted by thousands of soldiers, sailors from the naval base at Kronstadt, and workers, armed and ready for orders. Lenin initially tried to defer giving a speech, hoping that his refusal to address the crowd would send the message that he did not endorse the demonstrations. But soon it became impossible to avoid addressing the crowd. As he stepped out to address the insurgents, he privately castigated the other Bolsheviks for allowing things to get this out of hand. Then, instead of the marching orders the assembled soldiers and workers were hoping for, Lenin gave a speech that afternoon in which he urged constraint. The speech was short and off the cuff. He promised that their movement would win eventually, but that now was not the time for, quote, adventurism, and that patience was needed. These remarks caught the crowd very off guard and elicited a variety of actions. Some heeded the call and left. Others were convinced the Bolshevik leader was betraying them, and others still were just confused as to why Lenin would now be declining the seizure of power in the capital by the party he helped build. Wasn't that the whole point? While Lenin's address did officially put him on record as being against the whole plan, it was not enough to stop it in its tracks. After hearing Lenin talk, a large contingent of the demonstrators moved to the Tauride Palace, where both the provisional government and the Petro-Soviet sat in opposite wings. They demanded that the Petro-Soviet take power and abolish the government. This is where a phrase famous for expressing the frustration and exasperation with the Soviet leaders is uttered, when a worker threatened the SR Minister of Agriculture, Viktor Chernov, with a fist and yelled at him, "Take power when it is given to you." But the SR and Mensheviks-dominated Petro-Soviet did not take power. They refused. They shrunk at the prospect of responsibility for the revolution and feared that if the forces of the provisional government and the interests it represented turned on them, as they surely would if the Soviet tried to remove them from power, the entire revolution up to that point would be lost, swept away by the counter-revolution. Even at this crucial moment, even after Lenin was crystal clear that overthrowing the government at this point would be disastrous, the Bolshevik leadership as a group was not 100% convinced that this was not the moment they had all been waiting for, and wondered if they should maybe go all in on an armed insurrection against the government. Soon enough, however, two pieces of news impelled them to immediately look for ways to extricate the party from its involvement with the armed uprising. First, the news that the All-Russian Executive Committee of Soviets, the overarching National Executive Committee of Soviets, not to be confused with the Petro-Soviet, which represented only Petrograd, had called to mobilize troops from the front to restore order in the capital. And second, that the provisional government was attempting to mobilize those regiments of the city garrison that were not in support of the Bolsheviks against the insurgency, largely by appealing to the Lenin as a German agent narrative that we know had been dogging Lenin for months now. Faced with almost certain defeat, on the morning of the 5th, Pravda carried an announcement from the Bolshevik Central Committee that the party was officially calling for an end to the demonstrations. The announcement declared that the goals of the demonstrations had been achieved, and so the demonstrations were no longer needed. Now, this was comically obviously not true. The provisional government still remained. Both the Bolsheviks here were pulling a maneuver seen throughout history across the world. When the leadership of a fighting force needs to save face during a retreat, they declare victory and go home. In the end, the casualty list for the July uprising was small, shockingly so for just how much tension had seemed about to explode into violence. Trotsky cites an investigative committee formed after the fact that found the number of dead to be 29, the number injured 114, and that the numbers were split more or less evenly between the insurgents and the forces mustered by the government to fight them. The aftermath of the July days was disastrous for the Bolsheviks, but before examining this, we need to be clear that, despite what is about to befall the party, Lenin's urging of restraint was strategically the only winning move for the party and its constituents. It is extremely likely that the workers could have stormed the Tauride Palace and arrested the ministers, overthrowing the provisional government and handing power to the Petro-Soviet. But such an outcome would have been faced by two realities. First, the Petro-Soviet would not have been the savior of the revolution the insurgents seemed to hope it would be. Yes, the Bolshevik Party counted among their numbers in Petrograd many of the most strategically important sectors of the city. The workers, the Kronstadt naval base, and, in increasing numbers, the soldiers in the city garrisons. But even in the Petro-Soviet, the Bolsheviks were a minority, and Petrograd was the most Bolshevized city in the entire country. In Moscow and all the other remaining cities, and at the army fronts, the Bolsheviks were gaining ground, yes, but not anywhere near a majority. Had the government been overthrown and power handed to the Soviets were still controlled by the Mensheviks and SRs. The bloc that had just demonstrated at the Congress of Soviets that they were basically in agreement with the provisional government on all major questions. The second reality is that it is highly doubtful the capital could have been held in the face of the inevitable counterattack. Loyal troops from the front would have been dispatched to the capital, and the party and their supporters would have been absolutely crushed in the counterattack. Remember back to episode 4, Setting the Stage, and the end of the Paris Commune. Petrograd would have almost certainly seen a bloody week to be remembered. And so, once again, Lenin's acute political acumen provided the correct assessment of the situation. Trotsky had this to say about the July days and what they revealed about the nature and course of the revolution up to that point. Quote, despite the paradoxical nature of the February regime, which the collaborators, note, he means here the Mensheviks and SRs, covered up with Marxist and populist hieroglyphs to boot, the true class relations were transparent enough. One only must not lose sight of the dual nature of the collaborating parties. The educated petty bourgeoisie leaned on the workers and peasants, but fraternized with the titled landowners and sugar factory owners. By entering into the Soviet system, through which the demands of the lower classes were raised up to the official government, the executive committee served at the same time as political cover for the bourgeoisie. The owner classes submitted to the executive committee as long as it kept moving power in their direction. The masses submitted to the executive committee so long as they hoped that it would become an organ of worker and peasant rule. In the Tauride Palace, opposing class tendencies intersected, while both of them took cover under the name of the executive committee, one in unconscious trust, the other in cold calculation. The battle, then, was for nothing more or less than the matter of who should rule the country, the bourgeoisie or the proletariat. End quote. The government and even the non-Bolshevik leaders in the Soviets immediately began slandering the Bolsheviks, and Lenin specifically, accusing them of orchestrating the attempted coup. While it was true that a large plurality of the demonstrators were Bolsheviks, and that the party leadership was split on what to do about the insurrection, as we just saw, the party itself had nothing to do with actually instigating the insurrection, and in the end, had everything to do with trying to hold it back to avert disaster. Already on the evening of the 4th, the Counter-Espionage Bureau of the government had formed an investigative committee to determine not whether, but to what extent, the Germans had been involved in the Bolshevik plot to overthrow the government. As we already know, Lenin was not a German agent, but he had used German assistance to get back home with the long-term goal of helping bring socialism back to Germany. Lenin wasn't even in Petrograd the morning of the 3rd when everything started popping off, and he had spent all of June arguing vehemently for restraint and patience. But it did not matter. Papers everywhere, liberal and socialist alike, to say nothing of the outright conservative and reactionary papers, piled on the Bolsheviks, whipping up anti-Bolshevik sentiment as much as possible. But the government, despite surviving the ordeal, did not escape entirely unscathed. The Soviet leaders had to do something in response to the insurrection, if only to mollify the masses of the capital. So on the 7th of July, socialist ministers of the government presented the Prime Minister, Prince Georgi Lvov, a cadet, with a list of general principles to serve as the basis of a new coalition. The principles included promises of setting elections to a constituent assembly for the 7th of September, calling for a meeting with the other Allied powers to work on an end to the war, meaningful labor reform, and the provision that Lvov really could not abide, The call to submit to the Constituent Assembly a bill to transfer all land ownership over to the peasants. Instead of agreeing to these terms, Lvov resigned. And Alexander Kerensky was named in his stead acting prime minister, the post he would occupy for the next 3.5 months until history caught up to everyone. But even without Lvov, the cadets made demands for staying in the government after the July uprising. Trotsky lists these demands as, quote, members of the government have a responsibility only to their conscience, complete unity with the Allies, the restoration of discipline in the army, no social reforms whatsoever before the Constituent Assembly. An unwritten point was the demand for the deferral of elections to the Constituent Assembly, end quote. These demands were ultimately agreed to by the Mensheviks and SRs. They feared that without the cadets, the government would collapse, which would mean, God forbid, the Soviets would have to assume full governing authority. For a political bloc that was by its own nature incapable of assuming power and making decisions, and had just all been frozen in fear when faced with armed workers demanding they do just that, this was inconceivable. As the new prime minister, Kerensky made it his mission to do away with the Bolsheviks once and for all, and cracked down hard. He gave many speeches decrying the anarcho-Bolshevik plot and the Bolshevik leadership. Several of their newspapers were shut down, and arrest warrants were issued for Lenin, Zinoviev, and Kamenev. The first two were able to escape into the underground, but Kamenev was arrested and jailed on the 9th of July, along with many other well-known Bolsheviks among the workers, soldiers, and Kronstadt sailors. The government also took several steps toward controlling the workers and soldiers, including ordering all weaponry and military hardware possessed by civilians be turned over, and keeping the drawbridges over the Neva River open so that workers could not easily move from their quarters on the far side of the river to the center. To a casual observer, it seemed like the Bolsheviks, as a political force, were done with. Their leaders were disgraced, either in hiding or under arrest. Their newspapers were shut down, and anti-Bolshevik sentiment was high, even in Petrograd, the most Bolshevik-friendly city in Russia. But not 4 months later, as Michael Scott would say, the turntables will definitely turn. Because even though the party was at its lowest point yet, the ideas for which the party stood were still as relevant and cogent as ever, and the contradictions of the revolution were not going away. So next time, we will see the Bolsheviks start the trek back up the mountain, and the masses start to flock to them once again. Thank you so much for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.